You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Film historian Scott Eyman returns to the show this week. His books include great biographies of Cary Grant, John Wayne, John Ford, Louis B. Mayer, and a dual biography of Henry Fonda and James Stewart. I love that one. He's also collaborated on a couple of books with Robert Wagner. His latest book might be his very best, which is saying a lot because they're all first rate. It's called 20th Century Fox, Daryl F. Zanuck, and the Creation of the Modern Film Studio. Scott Eyman, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, good to be here again. Good to see you.
How do you decide? This book is related to other books you've written, like, you know, your John Ford book, for instance. How do you decide what you're going to write about? What led you to this one?
Well, what led me to this one essentially was the pandemic. The end of 2019, I had put Cary Grant to bed. He came out, 10 months, 11 months later. And I was looking around for what to do next, except if things were just starting to close down. And I thought, I make no claims to second sight, but I thought it might be worse than they were saying it was going to be. So the libraries were starting to close down. Everything was closing down. So I'm looking around. At a time like that, I start going through files to see what I've got. Stuff that I put away, interviews that I did and never did anything with. I collect string for years on various subjects, and a lot of the stuff never gets used. But with things closing down, I started looking through my files to see what I had, and I came across all these wonderful things on with Fox and Zanuck. I had two interviews with Richard Zanuck, which were fascinating. Interviews with a lot of Alice Faye, which was interesting. There's just a lot of stuff that I collected over the years that I'd never used because I never wrote about 20th Century Fox in any kind of depth. And I always loved Zanuck, and I loved his films. I loved his films at Warner's, and I loved his films when he took over Fox, all the way through into the 50s. So I just sort of made an executive decision that this was going to be the project that could sustain me for the next 18 months or so.
It's a great book. I really love it. It's got a little TCM logo on it. What role did TCM play in this book? Or are they just helping you out distributing?
Well, they're not. They have a publishing arrangement with Running Press, which is an imprint at Hachette. But I never dealt with TCM at all on the book, except in terms of stills. The book was done as a conventional writer editor relationship with my editor at Hachette, Cindy Sapala, who's excellent. But I did have access to the TCM archive of digital archive of stills, which was a big help.
I understand that there are other channels other than TCM, but I never watch any of them.
I've heard rumors, but I couldn't attest to that fact directly.
TCM is the only one I care about.
Exactly.
Well, it felt like you could have written an entire book about William Fox, the man whose name remained on the gates long after he left. Tell us a little bit about Fox. I guess specifically what I want to ask you is, why was there this simultaneous rise of studios in Hollywood that were run by Jewish men?
Because the Gentiles didn't want them. This is an oversimplification, but not by much. The theater, the legitimate, because the competition for movies in the early days of the movies, if we're talking now 110, 120 years ago, was the legitimate theater in vaudeville. And there were some Jews in the legitimate theater, and there were some Jews in vaudeville. But by and large, it was Gentile. And the Gentile predominated, didn't want anything to do with the movie business because it was crass, it was vulgar, it was cheap, it was tawdry. They just didn't take it seriously. So essentially, it was there for the taking. So the Jews took it because no one else wanted it. And in the process, they built empires for themselves.
And Fox was a pretty aggressive empire builder.
To say the least. But Fox, actually, you say he would be a good subject for a full-length book. There are one or two full-length books on William Fox. I wouldn't want to do one because I find him a very negative personality, operating out of vindictiveness and ego and assertiveness. But when he said, and since for the first 10 years of its existence, Fox Films basically was an exploitation outfit. They really were not interested in doing anything of quality. They were churning out Tom Mix movies and churning out Theda Bear movies and churning out William Farnham movies. And the critics basically ignored them because the mixed films are pretty good. The Berra films, we don't know because there's only one surviving complete Theda Berra film. And there are a couple of William Farnham films. But there's a lot of the Fox product of that era that's simply the World War I era that doesn't survive. That said, one day in the middle 20s, William Fox woke up. Well, it was more like 1923, 24. Fox woke up and decided he wanted status. He wanted credit for being a great benefactor of art. So he radically upgraded his production facilities and upgraded the content of his films. He brought over F.W. Murnau from Germany on an exclusive contract. He gave John Ford his head. He gave Frank Borzage his head. He hired Henry King. He really amped up the staffing at the Fox studio. And the result was in the latter portion of the 1920s, Fox was absolutely on a par with MGM or Paramount in terms of quality of product. So but you, that didn't change his essentially negative personality.
So would you call him an artist or just a businessman?
He was a real estate guy. Uh-huh. He didn't really, he stayed in New York 50 weeks a year, 48 weeks a year. He went to California only with a gun to his head. He would delegate responsibility for the running of the studio to a Saul Wurzel or to Winfield Sheehan or to somebody else. Basically, Fox started in the business by buying one Nickelodeon, started to make money with it, then bought another Nickelodeon in the same way that Louis B. Mayer did, and became a very powerful exhibitor in the New York State area. But he was a real estate guy with a passing interest in films, insofar as it filled up. It was a way of another revenue stream besides the theaters, because in that era you could play your own films. You didn't have to worry about antitrust things like that. So by making his own films and making them cheap, and most of them were made cheaply, he had two revenue streams coming from basically the same operation, the theater and the theater that played his own films. So it was a way of ramp. And then, but he put most of his expansion area money into more real estate, more theaters. That was his great passion was theaters, much more so than movie making.
So when he tried to acquire other studios is where things went wrong for him.
Well, his timing was bad. It would have worked out fine, and he would have basically been the czar of the American movie business. But he invested tens of millions of dollars to buy Loews Incorporated, which was the parent company of MGM, and as well as a major theater circuit of its own. And then along came the stock market crash in 1929. And all this huge real estate investment that Fox had bought was now worth far less than the mortgages he was holding. And it began a slow motion a bankruptcy, basically. And he lost control of the studio in 1930, a year after the stock market crash.
And at that time, Daryl F. Zanuck was working at Warner Brothers. He was head of production at Warner Brothers.
Zanuck had started out as a writer at Warner Brothers, a writer slash publicist at Warner Brothers, segued into one of their main screenplay writers, and gradually ascended to head of production under Jack Warner. But Jack Warner always had someone running the nuts and bolts. You know, Jack Warner wanted people to think he was head of production. Actually, he wasn't, because Zanuck ran production until he left to form 20th Century Pictures in 1933, after which Hal Wallace basically ran production for 10 years until almost the end of World War II, at which point Steve Trilling basically took over as head of production under Jack Warner. But Zanuck ran production at Warner Brothers for almost 6 years. The great gangster pictures, Jimmy Cagney, Edward G. Robinson, the musicals, 42nd Street, Footlight Parade, those were all done under Zanuck.
I was very interested to see the point that you made, and I had never considered it before, and then I immediately pulled out 42nd Street and watched it again, that Zanuck had sort of saved the musical by applying the ethos of the gangster picture to the musical.
Yeah. And by injecting the reality of America in 1932 and 33 into the musical. In other words, the music, you had two strains of musicals. You had the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers musicals, which were just starting up at this point, which were completely an escape from what was going on outside the theater. Zanuck's musicals made a big point of bringing in the reality of the Depression into the movies, where, you know, Warner Baxter tells Ruby Keeler, you're going out there an unknown, but you've got to come back a star, because if she doesn't come back a star, the show closes, everybody's out of work, and Warner Baxter's heart is going to pop and he's going to die. So everything's hinging on survival is hinging on whether or not Ruby Keeler can knock the audience dead.
And in Footlight Parade, Cagney is going to, he's desperate to get the contract for the prologues or whatever the plot was to
exactly
get this musical.
Yeah, the wolf is always at the door in a Zanuck film of the Warner Brothers period, whether it's a conventional dramatic feature or a musical. And the wolf doesn't get to the door in the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies that RKO was making. There was a real divide in what the audience was being given in terms of musicals in that period. And actually, it's very interesting. You could write a book just about that.
I love the Astaire Rogers musicals at RKO. They're marvelous. And whenever there is a musical number, there is virtually no cuts. They always just show Fred and Ginger in full frame doing the dance without any cuts at all. And a Busby Berkeley musical number, like Lullaby of Broadway or By a Waterfall, has a gajillion cuts. There's so many cuts. Did Zanuck
have a Busby Berkeley number isn't about the dancing. The Fred and Ginger movies are all about the dancing. That's what you're paying to see, is the extraordinary grace and style of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. The Busby Berkeley numbers are more like close order drill than they are about dancing. Now, there are exceptions. The Lullaby Broadway number, which is my favorite Busby Berkeley number of all time, where you've got 100 people tap dancing in unison, and it's terrifying. The sound of 100 people tap dancing in unison is terrifying. Well, who knew until Busby Berkeley showed us that? That actually does involve dance. But again, that's a sequence that would never have happened at any other studio, because it's a complete narrative that ends in death and destruction.
Yeah, it's kind of a very strange musical number where I can't remember it's Winnie Shaw, I believe, who's the singer.
I think so. Yeah,
and she goes out dancing and falls out a window to her death.
Right, right. The end. Yeah.
And that's a whole, I mean, not only is it a great musical number, but it's got like pre-film noir-ish kind of shadows. And
yeah,
it's great cinema for sure.
Very expressionist shots, actually, if you look at it.
Yeah.
Very expressionist shots. Yeah, I think it's a dazzling piece of work.
It really is. And so Zanuck, definitely an artist, you would say.
He was the ultimate example of someone who could put on either hat, either the artist or the businessman, depending upon the day, depending upon the picture, depending upon who he was dealing with. Certain pictures he made, he would make no pretense to having artistry. They were made to make a buck. And that was clear from the story conferences up front. Other pictures where he saw that there was something more than a commercial entity, he would push and push and push for the most three-dimensional characters he could get, for the subtlest storytelling. So he had a foot in both camps.
Come on along and listen to the Lullaby of Broadway, the hippery and ballyhoo, the Lullaby of Broadway. The rumble of a subway train, the rattle of the taxis, the daffodils who entertain at Angelo's and Maxie's. When a Broadway baby says goodnight, it's early in the morning. Manhattan babies don't sleep tight until the dawn. Good night, baby. Good night. Milkman's on his way. Sleep tight, baby. Sleep tight. Let's call it a day. Oh, come on along and listen to the Lullaby of Broadway, the hidey-eye and boop-a-doo, the Lullaby of Broadway. The band begins to go to town and everyone goes crazy. You rock-a-bye your baby round till everything gets hazy. Hush-a-bye, I'll buy you this and that, you hear a daddy say. And baby goes home to her flat to sleep all day.
Ah, Dick Powell singing The Lullaby of Broadway. And we're talking this week with Scott Imon. He's one of the great film historians, and he's written a brand new book about Daryl F. Zanuck. It's called 20th Century Fox, Daryl F. Zanuck and the Creation of the Modern Film Studio. Scott Imon has also written books about Cary Grant, Henry Fonda and James Stewart, Cecil B. DeMille, and many others. We've got lots more with Scott Imon right after this. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. You're listening to KSCO.
How did Zanuck then leave Warner's and come to Fox?
He got into a fight with Harry Warner. Not a fist fight, although Zanuck was perfectly capable of getting into fist fights as well, and did. He got into a fight with Harry Warner because when Roosevelt was inaugurated in 1933 and declared a bank holiday, all the movie studios froze their salaries and instituted pay cuts. And they promised that when the bank holiday was over, the pay cuts would be rescinded. And I think it was several weeks went by, and the pay cuts were rescinded. And Harry Warner wanted to hold on for a couple more weeks and keep more of the money before returning it to his salaried employees. And Zanuck had promised everybody that when the bank holiday was over, full salaries would be restored. So he felt he'd been left hung out to dry. But beyond that, he and Harry Warner never got along. He always got along okay with Jack. Most people couldn't stand Jack, got along well with Harry. Zanuck couldn't stand Harry because he thought Harry was cheap and petty, and he hated cheap and petty. Beyond that, Zanuck understood it would have left anyway because Warner Brothers was essentially a family business, and Zanuck wasn't in the family. So he was never really going to get the kind of money and the kind of profit percentage that he was beginning to feel entitled to because he was driving the machine. And it was succeeding, and the Warner Brothers was making money. He decided to go out on his own. He had great self-confidence in his own abilities. So he formed a company with Joe Schenck called 20th Century Pictures, releasing through United Artists, which was desperate for product at that point because Chaplin was slowing up. Chaplin was only going to make a picture every 4 or 5 years. Fairbanks was semi-retired. Pickford was semi-retired. There wasn't any product. So United Artists was desperate for products. So they signed up 20th Century to release through UA. And Zanuck made almost 20 pictures in 2 years, three quarters of which made money, which is a nice batting average if you can get it. And at that point, he got into a squabble with United Artists over because he thought he was entitled to a percentage of the gross. And United Artists said, no, you're just only entitled to a percentage of the net, which, of course, was costing Zanuck money. And since he was carrying probably 60 or 70% of the company at that point, he decided, well, who needs this? At that point, Fox is sucking wind. William Fox had left 4 or 5 years earlier. It was being run essentially by the Chase Bank at this point, who were so deep in debt in terms of the money they'd lent out to Fox that they had cut off any further loans. So Fox had this beautiful chain of theaters, including the Roxy in New York, gorgeous showcase theaters. As Zanuck said, they had the best theater chain and the worst movies in the business. So Zanuck's portfolio, when he went in to merge with Fox, was very simple. He had a huge studio. He had considerable overhead. And he had to do better than what Fox had been doing for the last 3 or 4 years. And he didn't think it would be that hard. And in fact, it wasn't. Because from the get-go, he began making movies that people started going to see.
And we talked earlier about how the heads of these studios were all Jewish, all the moguls. And Zanuck was not Jewish.
No, he was the only one. See, he's kind of on a cusp. He's not really a founding mogul. The founding generation of moguls is essentially around World War I. Zucker, Lasky, DeMille at Paramount, which starts up, famous players Lasky starts up in 1913. The Warner Brothers start up in 1918. Zanuck doesn't really take control of a production company until 1933 when he goes out with 20th Century. But Zanuck was a Gentile. He was the only Gentile amongst his generation and amongst the previous generation. But because his name was Zanuck, everybody kind of assumed that he was Jewish. In fact, no, there was no Jewish blood in Zanuck whatsoever.
And he never encountered any resistance. I think that Walt Disney felt that there was a Jewish conspiracy that was keeping him from fully realizing his studio in his early years.
Well, Disney had gotten taken to the cleaners by some Jewish distributors that were handling his early pictures. And he extrapolated from that. And possibly, I mean, I don't know to what extent Disney Kansas upbringing instilled in him any kind of anti-Semitism. But he had a problem with Jews after his early days in the movie business because he felt he'd been shafted. And in fact, he had been shafted. But that's what happens in the movie business. It's not necessarily limited to the Jewish inhabitants of the movie business. That's the way the movie business is. You need someone watching your back in the movie business.
Well, he was right that there was a conspiracy, and he was right that the people who were conspiring against him were Jews, but it wasn't a Jewish conspiracy.
No, not necessarily. No, not necessarily.
So Zanuck takes control of the studio, of this new studio, 20th Century mm-hmm. Fox. How did they decide on why did they keep Fox's name? And I guess because it was a merger of these two studios.
Well, it was a merger of two studios, but Fox was by far the bigger operation. They had this huge studio on Pico Boulevard, where the studio still is. They also had a subsidiary studio on Western Avenue, which had been the B picture, where Tom Mix had worked and where the B pictures were made. They had a huge infrastructure. They had hundreds and hundreds of theaters. They had distribution outlets all over the country. It was a big operation with a huge overhead. And at 20th Century Pictures, Zanuck had rented space at the United Artists Studio, which was the old Pickford Fairbanks studio in Santa Monica. And they had a corner in the lot, and he had trouble getting studio space because it was always booked. Because he and Sam Goldwyn were basically covering the entire United Artists operation at that point. And he had it was a constant problem getting studio space. So the theory was that when the merger was announced, it would be Fox 20th Century. And Zanuck announced that was a deal breaker. He wouldn't do the deal if it was Fox 20th Century. It was 20th Century Fox or nothing. And Fox capitulated because they had no choice. The water was basically at their chest. It had been at their chin. It was now at their chest, but it was still a perilous situation for the Fox studio. They had to get someone in there who knew how to make movies that people wanted to see.
When did they start using their famous fanfare?
The fanfare was initially the logo was 20th Century Pictures. That was the logo of the studio Zanuck formed with Schenck in 1933. The fanfare, I believe, came in 1935 when Alfred Newman composed the underscore for it, the drum roll.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so iconic.
Oh, it is. It's great. It's great. It's my favorite movie trademark of all.
I was interested in your, we're talking with Scott Iman, and his new book is called 20th Century Fox, Daryl F. Zanuck and the Creation of the Modern Film Studio. One of my favorite sections of your book, and there's so much in it, it's really a wonderful book, was the discussion of when television came in, I guess 25 years into this story. Mm-hmm. And the struggle with trying to lure people back from their TV screens included experiments with widescreen. And I also remember reading in your wonderful book about John Ford, Print the Legend, that Ford had contempt for widescreen mm-hmm. when he made his Cinerama movie, for instance. Right. You know, he has a sequence in How the West Was Won, and you're not supposed to have close-ups, and you're not supposed to have people crossing the screen. And Ford said, "Oh well," and he put all those things in
because he was contrary. Ford was contrary,
and yet he made a lot of pictures at Fox without any.
He didn't make a lot of pictures in CinemaScope at Fox.
No,
he tried. He tried CinemaScope. Mr. Roberts is in CinemaScope.
Yeah,
the Searchers is in VistaVision, which is 166. But The Long Gray Line is also in CinemaScope. So he tried a couple pictures in CinemaScope, and he didn't really like it. I think he felt that Ford's gifts, aside from drama, were compositional, the way he could communicate drama visually. And I think he felt, with some justification, that he was a master of composition in terms of the 1:3:3 screen ratio. And I don't think he necessarily wanted, at the age of 60 or so, to try to retool his visual sense, that he was doing just fine under the old 1:3:3, which became 1:6:6. And in fact, his later films like Liberty Valance and Donovan's Reef look just fine in 1:6:6. You know, he's just, I think he thought it was too extreme. I think he thought scope was too much of an extreme ratio. And if you look at the early scope films, The Robe, How to Marry a Millionaire, basically the actors stand in a row in front of the camera, you know, and it's sort of a return to the late 1920s and the beginning of sound, when it was difficult to move the camera without having the microphone pick it up. So the camera never moved. So they did as much with medium shots as they possibly could. And the actors tend to stand in a line and address each other as if they're standing on stage. And if you look at the early scope films, there's a lot of that going on, because the focus was, it was very hard to focus the early scope lenses. And once you got focus, you didn't want to cut any more than was absolutely necessary, you know? So it was a problematic process, very problematic process, but Zanuck bet big on scope, and it paid off short term. It didn't pay off long term, because after 5 or 6 years, the novelty wore off, and once again, they had to begin to figure out how to lure people back into the theater, because just a big picture and stereophonic sound was not in and of itself enough to do it by 1957 or 1958 anymore. But it was in 1953 and 54.
I remember hearing an interview with Robert Altman, who made a significant 20th Century Fox film at one point, saying that he would just see, since most movies end up on television anyway, and this was before widescreen television, he says, I just center most of the action in the middle of the screen and ignore the sides of the screen. I guess is one approach to why.
Well, that works, but Altman had a very loosey-goosey visual style too.
Yeah,
you know, there's a lot of air in Robert Altman's frames, generally speaking. That's not what makes Altman's films interesting, is his great visual sense. There are a few exceptions. McCabe and Mrs. Miller has a certain haunting quality. All that snow and the Leonard Cohen songs.
Yeah,
but a lot of Altman's films are kind of indifferently shot, it seems to me.
As opposed to, say, Stagecoach.
Yeah.
I often think of that scene in Stagecoach when Duke is walking, following Claire Trevor down a hallway, and she's stepping out into the night, and she's in focus, he's in focus, then he stops and he talks to the cook who helps him light a cigarette and tells him not to go to Lordsburg, and it's one of the most beautifully composed squares a film that you've ever seen.
No, when Ford was on his game and plugged in to the movie, there was no better visual dramatist than John Ford. And Zanuck knew that. I quote Zanuck in the book, talking about that he thought John Ford pound for pound was the best director in the history of motion pictures, simply because he could make even good dialogue irrelevant with a shot, which is the ultimate, if you can get that in a movie.
Well, would you say that that's partially because Ford had started in silent films and therefore knew how to tell stories without bothering
Absolutely. I think that was the core of it. I think most of the great visual stylists, always excepting Orson Welles, certainly the first, 50 years of the movies were all silent movie guys. Hitchcock, Ford, Borzage. I mean, they were all silent movie guys. Murnau.
Looking at The Searchers, for instance, in the first 10 or 12 minutes of The Searchers, there's very little dialogue and all kinds of story that is conveyed through visuals.
The whole setup, all the exposition is basically done visually.
I'm
Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we'll return now to our conversation with Scott Eyman. He's one of the great film historians. He's written biographies of John Wayne and Cary Grant, Henry Fonda and James Stewart. He's the co-writer of a couple of memoirs with Robert Wagner that are great. And he just published a new book called 20th Century Fox, Daryl F. Zanuck and the Creation of the Hollywood Film Studio.
we've got to talk a little bit about Zanuck's behavior. I mean, he would never have survived in the Me Too era.
Oh, he would have lasted, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, I think. Before the war, before the lid blew off. But Zanuck's behavior is not just bizarre and over the top for 2021. It's bizarre and over the top for 1945. I mean, no other studio had had a daily 4 o'clock business meeting with one of the chorus girls or starlets on the line. But Zanuck did for years. That was the norm. And, you know, a lot of the girls went along and a lot of the girls didn't go along and had to come up with, you know, ways around it. You know, I remember talking to Colleen Gray, this is years ago, who was the leading lady in Nightmare Alley, the original Nightmare Alley, the Tyrant Power. And she's the girl at the beginning of Red River, the one who gets killed by the Indians off screen. And she had heard about Zanuck and she went in to talk to Zanuck to get loaned out to Howard Hawks to do Red River. And she told me how nervous she was because she'd heard the stories about Zanuck. And Colleen Gray was from Nebraska. So she went in and to derail him from like lunging at her or making a pass at her, she started talking about her hometown in Nebraska. And she'd never been to Wahoo, which was his hometown, Wahoo, Nebraska, to anything to deter him from focusing on her as a woman. You know, because she just wanted to avoid the whole thing entirely. But that's what actresses had to do. They had to come in with some evasion to avoid getting chased around the desk.
In your book, Irene Mayer Selznick, I think it is, has the best line. Mm-hmm. She says,
"Oh yeah."
You want to tell me, what does she say?
No, go ahead.
She says, it's a good thing that Zanuck is a Gentile or he would give Jews a bad name.
That's right. Exactly. But none of the other moguls were anywhere near that flagrant. I mean, Mayer, no. Goldwyn, no.
Cohn was pretty bad.
Even Jack Warner rarely indulged with the talent. I mean, he had a thing with Marilyn Miller in the late 20s, but you know, he really didn't dabble much in terms of the talent. It simply wasn't a big deal. Cohn, you hear a lot of stories about Cohn, some of which I'm sure are true. But Zanuck was really an outlier amongst the major studio heads.
It was. Do you think, from what you know about him, that his aggressiveness with women was a power thing, sex thing? What?
It's a power thing. I think there's a certain generalizations can be made about behavior that rampant. For one thing, it's a power thing. Partially, it's a sex thing. I also think it's a revenge thing. Daryl Zanuck was 5 feet 5 inches tall, had buck teeth, was never going to get a lot of gorgeous women to look twice at him, you know, if he hadn't been a movie mogul. He just simply didn't. And he had a nasal voice. I mean, he's not the physical package that anybody's dreaming about.
Yeah.
Harvey Weinstein had his own physical issues. I think for these guys who grew up feeling extraneous to the world at large, who weren't on the football team, who the cheerleaders didn't care about looking at or want to talk to particularly, I think there was a certain vengeance thing going on as well. That if they didn't get theirs when they were 16 and 22, by God, they'd get it when they were 45 or 50. But that's, I could be wrong. I mean, that's my reading of it. But you didn't really see the guys who were the worst were also the homeliest, you know. And it seems to me that that's probably the tell.
Tell me a little bit about what you would say were the most important films that Zanuck made during the time he was at 20th Century Fox.
Well, it depends on your preferences. I love the family dramas. I love A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. I love How Green Is My Valley. I love The Grapes of Wrath. And I love the noirs that he began doing after the war. Boomerang and the Kazan pictures. It seems to me they have a vitality and a visceral impact that, especially in the post-war era, that most studio pictures didn't have. MGM was gasping for air because everything at MGM was done by committee. And the MGM way of movie making, the MGM theory of movie making, was completely obliterated by changing audience tastes after World War II. And they struggled and struggled and struggled, and they never really solved the problem, ever. Occasionally, they'd have a big hit, North by Northwest or Ben-Hur or Battleground, but they were few and far between, and they because they couldn't really figure out how to retool the MGM way of doing things for the second half of the 20th century. Zanuck didn't have that problem. He believed in because when you read his story notes, the issue is, everything, as I mentioned, everything at MGM was done by committee. Nothing at Fox was done by committee. There was an absolute chain of command. It went from Zanuck to the producer to the writer. And both the producer and the writer were always in the room with Zanuck during the story conferences. There were no doubts about what Zanuck wanted to see and how Zanuck wanted the story structured and what scene three led to scene four and what followed scene four. It was all laid out. All the writer had to do was essentially dialogue it and characterize it. But the story structure, the movement of the story was often dictated directly by Zanuck. No other studio had that facility. And no other studio had his nimbleness, his intellectual nimbleness to shift with shifting times. Mayer couldn't do it. Sam Goldwyn couldn't do it. David Selznick couldn't do it. They all essentially were rendered irrelevant by changing times. Paramount was never a one-man operation. They survived fairly effectively because they bet on stars. Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, whoever. But Fox was a one-man operation, and that one man was Daryl Zanuck. And that was extraordinary because he was running a movie studio. He's putting out 40 pictures a year, but it's essentially a one-man operation in the same way that Selznick or Goldwyn were a one-man operation, but they're just putting out one picture a year, maybe, you know?
Right.
Zanuck could compartmentalize and ramped up a system where they could put out 30 and 40 pictures a year that all had a certain pulse, that all had a certain drive, that all had a narrative rhythm to them, you know, because it came from Zanuck.
And he had that input in all of the pictures that came out of the studio.
Every A picture, not B's. He wouldn't mess around with B's. B's he didn't care about. He didn't put his name on B's. It was 20th Century Fox Presents. With the pictures that he produced personally, it was Daryl F. Zanuck Presents. But every A picture, he would supervise the script conferences directly. Yes. And say, what we've got here is good, or what we've got here is terrible, and it has to be completely redone, and here's how it's going to be redone. And then he would lay out from the Fox logo in through the first reel. And after that, he might leave them alone.
So eventually he left the studio, and his son became head of the studio.
Yeah, he left in 1956 to go into independent production, because he was burned out, basically. He came back 6 years later after the Cleopatra debacle. It was a dull picture, Cleopatra, but that wasn't really the problem. The problem was incompetent production, that where most of the money that was spent wasn't on the screen, because it was just a series of chaotic production decisions, which drove Zanuck crazy, because he knew what was going on and he knew the money was just being flushed down the toilet. So he came back and as chairman of the board and installed his son, Richard, as the head of production, and they were very effective for a while. Their first picture out of the box was The Sound of Music, which covered a lot of problems. But 4 or 5 years down the road, problems arose again. And Zanuck at this point was beginning to get a little senile. Dementia was starting to set in a little bit. And he was getting erratic and spending basically a lot of time with his girlfriends and very little time attending to the studio business. And Richard was having trouble getting approvals from his father, and the studio was kind of grinding to a halt. And at that point, Zanuck fired his son. It didn't save his job. He was kicked upstairs 8 or 9 months later to emeritus position. And he was essentially out of the movie business at that point, which was good because his mental faculties were in steep decline.
And did Richard stay in the business after he'd been fired from 20th Century Fox?
Richard did just fine. He went into production with David Brown, Zanuck Brown Productions. Richard and David Brown produced Jaws. They produced The Sting. They produced Driving Miss Daisy. they produced a whole slew of extremely fine and often extremely commercial pictures. Richard made more money off Jaws than his father had in 20 years in the movie business, which I'm sure probably drove his father nuts if his father was compos mentis enough to realize it, because his father was extraordinarily competitive with his son.
Jaws is really the film that created the whole blockbuster tech, that and another little thing called Star Wars really created that blockbuster idea that dominates movies today. Kind of unfortunate.
Absolutely. But Jaws is a great movie. Jaws is a wonderful movie. You look at that picture today, and there's really, with the exception of one or two shots of the shark, where the shark is chomping down on Robert Shaw, and it doesn't really look like a shark. It looks like a giant toy. It's a magnificently produced picture and impeccably made and beautifully acted and shot and scored and everything else. You know, you can't begrudge Jaws its worldwide success.
I'll never forget seeing it for the first time here in a little town here called Capitola, which is right on the beach in the middle of the summer, filled with beach going tourists. Perfect movie for that that week.
I'll bet they stayed off the beach.
When you write your biographies of people, you know, they often die at the end. And that's kind of
people
what
happened. Have a way of doing that. People do that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of what happened to 20th Century Fox. 20th Century Fox really doesn't exist anymore.
Well, that was one of the interesting things about the book, because I mean, I wrote a book about MGM and MGM barely exists. You know, it's kind of a vestigial organization. They might put out one or two films a year, but it's doesn't exist in the sense that it existed when Louis B. Mayer or even Dorie Sherry was running it. Companies grow feeble and senile just like people do. And what happened to Fox would have angered Zanuck, although he would have understood what was going on because he had a big picture about the movie business. He understood the movie business very well on the cellular level. What would have shocked him was the fact that it was bought out by Disney, because when Zanuck was alive, Disney was a niche boutique studio. They made animated shorts and one or two an animated picture every 3 years or so, and maybe three live action movies a year. And that was it. That was it. They weren't any competition to Fox or Paramount or MGM at all. But Disney has had it approached its second century, Disney has achieved its maturity. Whereas when Fox, 20th Century Fox, was approaching its second century, it was kind of just hobbling along on a cane and a walker, you know? And so it was easy to pick off, because Disney wanted it for all the right reasons, because Fox wasn't really doing anything with the library. Fox wasn't doing anything with all those thousands of story properties that they owned. Whereas Disney is going to plunder them for streaming, remake them as they've done with Nightmare Alley, which opens next week. And there's all sorts of stuff there that can be rebranded for 21st century audiences, and that the studio was doing nothing with. And that's a function of an aggressive corporation versus a senescent corporation.
Well, you know, we've covered a lot of ground, and we've only just touched the little bit of this book, 20th Century Fox, Daryl F. Zanuck and the Creation of the Modern Film Studio. Scott Iman, what are you going to do next?
I'm working on a book about Charlie Chaplin. That's all I'll say.
Okay. Well, I can't wait to read that, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us about it then.
Anytime, Gary. Happy to do it.
Scott Iman, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.